Well, this morning, our story turns a little bit of a corner. If Exodus were to be split into a multi-movie franchise, then I think part one would have finished last week with Richard's message as the ocean fell back into place behind this newly formed nation of Israel. Perhaps the last shot would have been Moses staring out over the waves in the sea as bits of armor and broken chariots wash up on the beach below him before it faded to black, and now we'd all be waiting till Christmas 2020 for part two. Unfortunately, we can just keep reading this morning, and so as part two of the story begins, Israel, they turn their backs to Egypt in the past, and they begin this journey off into the brighter future that God has in store for them. And so perhaps the first shot of part two, it would be of the party which is being held here at the start of chapter 15. As this chapter begins, Israel, they pause to acknowledge what God has done for them. From the doubting, kind of fickle complaining just only a few hours earlier on the other side of the sea, now in light of what God has done, they are moved to song. And so in the first 21 verses of chapter 15, right there next to the sea, they hold the first ever hashtag Israel conference, and they record their first ever worship album together as a community. With Miriam as a worship leader. Have a read of it. It's triumphant. It's powerful, powerful stuff that's written there. But now the bright lights have faded and the sound equipment has been packed away, and it's time to face the real world again. It's time to put some of that newly strengthened faith and conviction into action. And as it turns out, well, it's not going to be quite that easy. And so we pick it up in verse 22 of chapter 15. And as we do here, can I ask if you're able, would you stand with me as we reverence the reading of God's word? Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. And for 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. And so the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" And then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood, and he threw it into the water, and the water became fit to drink. And there the Lord issued a ruling and instruction for them and put them to the test. He said, "If you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all of his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you." And then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and they camped there near the water. This is God's word for his church this morning. Have a seat. I'd agree with Kate a couple of weeks back when she said that in dissecting Exodus as we are, you kind of come across parts of the story from time to time that aren't overly familiar, that don't make the cut in kind of popular retellings of the story. If we're to remember anything between the ocean which has been parted and the Ten Commandments which are written on the slabs of stone, it's probably going to be the stuff which Julie is preaching about next week in chapter 16, the manna from heaven, the quail, the miraculous provision of God for his people's needs. But in between that, we get this little story in chapter 15 where we are this morning. And here, Israel, they turn their backs to the ocean, and they start heading south into the desert, into the unknown. And they don't know it right now, but here in the desert, in the wilderness, they're going to be spending the next 40 years of their lives. They think that the promised land is right there on the horizon. They think that their freedom and their blessing is within reach. But what they haven't reckoned with is that the biggest barrier to obtaining all of that is going to be themselves. Because God has got a much bigger plan for them in mind. It's for this reason that he's rescued them, not just that it's a good idea to rescue them, but because of a covenant, because of a promise made centuries earlier to the grandfather of this nation, to Abraham. A promise that said that through his children, the earth would be blessed. That in them, the world would see an example of what life looks like when it's lived in right relationship with God. And so it's not in the promised land, but it's in the wilderness, in the isolation, in the unknown, that they're to learn something of what it means to put that into practice. Because although they've seen the miraculous works of God in Egypt, although they've followed pillars of cloud and pillars of fire, and although oceans have parted in front of them, despite all of the loud music and the bright lights from just a few moments ago, God knows that it's going to take a little bit more than that for them to become who he wants them to be. That they're going to need to be stripped back, to learn about trust, to grow in their maturity. It's here in the unknown, in the wilderness, that they're to be refined, that they're to be tested. It's here where new life and purpose is going to be born in them. And so they head out, knowing nothing about this 40-year formation that lies ahead of them as they do. And their first steps, as we've just read, it doesn't really sound like it goes all that well. We read in verse 22 that they travel for 3 whole days without finding any water. I don't know if you remember back in chapter 12, but it tells us there that when they set out from Egypt, Israel numbered 600 men besides women and children, which is a little bit sort of patriarchal, but you've got to be thinking that there could be anywhere up to like 1.5 million people in this expedition party that heads out from Egypt. Add in all of the livestock that Scripture also says that they drive out along with them, and you're starting to kind of understand the difficulties of resourcing an expedition like this one. Those of you who have gone camping before will know how difficult it is just to get the necessities together, even just for a single person for a couple of days, let alone a whole family, let alone 1.5 million people out in the middle of the desert. It brings a certain level of complication, makes you wonder why you even go camping sometimes. In amongst all of the difficulties, though, facing them, water is certainly right up there. And finally, we read that they come to this place called Marah, where they find water. But to add insult to injury, in this instance, it turns out that the water is bitter and lifeless and therefore totally undrinkable. And we're helpfully told there in the text that that is why the place is called Marah, because Marah means bitter. And I'm kind of assuming that they didn't know that before they went there and tasted the water, otherwise they probably wouldn't have. And so they get there, and it's a problem. Just 3 days after all of the joy and all of the celebration, after the conference at the seaside, things have gone from bad to worse. And already some of that mood, which Richard was talking about last week, that kind of grumbling, those questions, weren't we better off when we were in Egypt? Some of that starts to rise back up again amongst the people. And they grumble to Moses, we read. Not to God, mind you, but to Moses. All of the words that they were singing just a few days earlier, all of these words of worship and praise of God's greatness, of his strength, of his sustaining power, his love for them, seemingly totally forgotten. It doesn't occur to them in this instance that the God who has just parted an entire ocean so that they can walk through on dry ground might have something to say or do in this situation where they're running short of water once again. They're very much rooted in their own practicality as a people, and that is why they're in the wilderness right now. They're here to learn lessons like this. They're here to learn that their own natural instincts need to be undone. They're here to learn about faith, about trust. They're here to become the people that God has called them to be. Unfortunately for them, Moses is there to lead the way and set an example. And his first response in the situation when the people begin to grumble is to cry out to God. And it turns out, surprise, surprise, that, well, in the midst of this, God is listening to him. There's a piece of wood over there, Moses, God says. Pick it up and throw it in the water. Moses doesn't even really seem to stop to consider how odd this suggestion is. He's seen enough, he's experienced enough to know not to question God and this kind of thing by now. So he just does it. And when the wood hits the water, what was once marrow, what was once bitter, is turned sweet and life-giving again. And the people are saved. It's a strange solution to the problem in front of them. I think it's highly unlikely that the wood had any kind of special water filtration properties of its own or anything like that. It was probably just a plain old piece of wood. But there's a point that's being made here. Here in the wilderness, in the moment of need, that the bitter water can only become drinkable, it can only become life-giving, it can only become sustaining when God intervenes. It's a lesson in trust. It's an opportunity to be reminded again that their God is not just the God who parts oceans. He's also intimately concerned with their most basic of human needs. Don't look to yourselves for the answer, he's saying. Look to me. Verse 25, he says this: if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all of his decrees, then I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. Trust in me, he says. Hope in me. And verse 27, it finishes that they leave Marah and they come to Elim. And there are 12 springs and 70 palm trees. There's an oasis in the desert. There's enough for everyone there. And they camp together as a community next to the water. When we started this series, I said on the first day, right back in Exodus chapter 1, that one of the main reasons that we're going to be spending time here together as a church is to embed ourselves in the story of a people who are learning what it means to be formed in the image of God, to be formed after his character, to become like him. We talked way back then, as they were in Egypt at the time, about the sense for them of living in a world which had moved on. The favor that they had once enjoyed as God's people there, as a powerful, influential nation, had diminished. And now, increasingly, they were being despised and pushed out to the margins. And I suggested then in that first sermon that in some ways the story of Exodus is the story of the church in the West as well. That we who once enjoyed a space at the heart of our culture, at the heart of our civilization, we are increasingly learning what it means to be a people who live on the margins of our society. And that in the story of formation, as Israel is pushed out into the wilderness for this formative period of time, that we too might be able to find some resonance for ourselves and be challenged again what it means to live as God's people. To be challenged again about what it means to be a people who are formed after him, in order that we too can be the blessing that he has called us to be to the world. I suspect that we have some learning to do, and that for us there's a bit of a wilderness moment which presents itself here in front of us right now. There's an opportunity here in front of us for formation, an opportunity to learn again something about our divine vocation as the church, about who we're called to be shaped around, about who we're to turn to, about who we're to trust in, about who our hope is to be found in. We're to see the wilderness that stretches before us, not so much as a threat, but as an invitation. An invitation for a journey into deeper things. Because out here, away from all the comfort and security, all manner of things come across our paths which might give us reason to pause and to doubt. I mean, there is a bitter evil in this world. I mean, you be aware of it. You see it all around you every day. You see it in the kinds of things like what we just prayed about, international crises in places like Myanmar. The travesty for the Rohingya people right now, what is being visited on them. We see it in every storm that wipes out islands in the Caribbean. We see it in every injustice, in every sickness, in every death, in every broken relationship, in every moment of uncertainty about the future, in every bitter moment, in every experience that might give us a reason to doubt. And the Bible has a way of describing this. It calls it sin. It's the spiraling consequences of a choice for a life apart from God, repeated a billion times over. It's what God is working to undo in Israel here. As we chose independence way back when, God is teaching them a lesson about dependence here and now. He's calling them back. He's reminding them again of where the real source of their life is to be found, in order that to the world they can express a different sort of hope, in order that they can be a point of difference to the world in which they live. And you need to hear this morning that is our calling today as the church as well. Because, well, into the bitterness of our human condition, into all that causes us to doubt, a piece of uninteresting and kind of ordinary looking wood has been thrown. It's not wood with any special properties of its own. It's a simple cross bearing the most unlikely and unseemly of solutions to all which ails us here. A cross bearing a body which is broken and torn, and yet this is the instrument of God for turning everything in us, everything all around us, all that is bitter and lifeless, into streams of living water. And then through the work of Jesus on the cross, we are reminded that a new way forward is possible. We're shown again what our relationship with God can look like. And we're called to be witnesses to that in an increasingly desperate world. I don't know if you've ever noticed in Matthew's telling of Jesus' life, but right there at the very beginning, Jesus and his family have become refugees in Egypt, and the time comes for them to go back home. And then the very next time we see Jesus, he's passing through some water. He's being baptized. I don't know if this is starting to ring some bells for you. And where does he go right after that? He heads off into the wilderness. Not for 40 years, but for 40 symbolic days. Starved of basic needs, prone to doubt, there Satan meets with Jesus and he tempts him. Tempts him with just the most basic of stuff. Turn your back on God, rely on your own strength, grumble about it, doubt. Satan tempts him to follow the pattern of every woman and man who's come before him. But Jesus, in that moment, he doesn't. He doesn't. And it's like when we read those words in Matthew, we're hearing Matthew whispering to us the same things that Moses would have said to God's people there on that day. Look to him, Matthew is saying. There is where your hope and your certainty lies. There is the one who can do for you what you cannot do for yourself. Trust in him. Have faith in him. Bring every bitterness and burden to him. Because he is the one who heals.